Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Before we get into this, I am going to go ahead and make the big announcement. The big announcement being what we'll be reading after Dubliners. The fourth book on the list is going to be, drumroll, Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. Wuthering Heights. I actually have no idea what Wuthering Heights is about. Is that the name of a school? Is it about a high school? Is this a high school drama? Or is Wuthering... What does Wuthering mean? I need to Google that. Of weather, characterized by strong winds. And am I saying it right? Wuthering.
Wuthering.
Wuthering. Wuthering Heights. Cool. So I wasn't saying it right, and I had no idea what it was, what it meant. Very, very good. Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte won the vote. There was 7 books that I listed to be potentials for the fourth book. They weren't all on the list. Some of them I had vetoed for later. Out of those 7, Wuthering Heights got 30% of the votes. There was 116 votes in total. So it won with 33 of those votes. So that's a pretty clear winner. But the good thing is that out of the rest of them, the other 6, that's a really even spread. It ranges from the lowest being 8 votes and the highest being 17. So it's a pretty even spread. 15%, 14.5, 14.5. 8%, 10%, yeah. So, all I mean to say by that is it's good that there wasn't one that, like, really, really stood out, and it's also good that there were none that, like, it didn't seem like anyone was interested in. They all got some votes, they all got some love. That gives me confidence to move forward with this list. It's a good list, is what I'm trying to say. Props to Hemingway for putting it together. Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. Go and get your copy of that book now, so we can start it on, we will be starting it on, the 5th of Feb. That's not that long. We've got a couple of weeks to get our books together. I am going to publish the Hemingway List version of this book in the next, 24 hours. Can I commit to that? Yeah, I think I can. Within the next 24 hours. I will put it into motion, at least. Let's say that much. It does take a couple of days, the whole process. So within a couple of days, you'll be able to purchase the official, the Hemingway List version of Emily Bronte's The Wuthering Heights. Wuthering Heights? It's not The Wuthering Heights. which is cool. That's awesome. Otherwise, you are welcome to get the free online version. There is the Gutenberg Press version, that's for free. You can find it for free online elsewhere. You can find a nice cheap copy in your local bookstore or a used copy in your local used bookstore. It's entirely up to you. It's exciting because Wuthering Heights is such a famous book. And Emily Bronte is such a famous author. But I have not read any Emily Bronte. So I'm excited. And like I said, I don't even know what the book's about. I thought it was a high school drama. I'm still not sure. All right, moving on. Let's see what we're up to today. We are going to be discussing Chapter 4 of Stephen Crane's The Blue Hotel, and then reading Chapter 5. The questions that I chucked out into the subreddit were these ones. The Swede's attitude in Chapter 4 has shifted dramatically. What is he thinking now, and what do you think is behind this shift? The Easterner, Mr. Blunk, what do you make of him? And is someone going to move against the Swede? If you were a guest at the Blue Hotel, what would you be doing now? Rockstar Bottom said, "So, I have been picturing the Easterner as a little Asian man, but I just realized that he's probably an Easterner like me, from New York or something. I ain't too bright, lol." No, it was a bit it was a bit vague because I'm still not 100% sure, but I think you're right. It is someone from New York, the east of the USA. It is confusing to call him an Easterner, though. And then it's also confusing because he's so... he says so little. When he speaks, he thinks and he speaks slowly, and he says short, non-committal sentence like, "I don't know, sir," or something like that. So it does lend itself to making you think maybe he doesn't speak English too well. And yeah, it built up that picture of an Easterner, as in an Asian person, in my head as well. And then I had the same thought of, "Oh, okay, no, wait, it's just someone from New York." But I wasn't, and I'm still not 100% sure. JMama8779 said, "Ha, same here, whoops-a-daisy." Was there something in the previous chapter that confirmed that he was, by Easterner, it meant New York? Maybe I skipped something there. Lipstick Singularity said, "I cast him as a calm version of Jack Black in my mind." Calm version. I don't know if I can imagine a calm version of Jack Black. I don't think I've ever seen the man calm. Cowboy? Oh, cowboy. Is Brad Pitt, a la Legends of the Fall, but more goofy, like in Burn After Reading. Oh, wow. Okay, in the cowboy in my head was like an older fellow, like the oldest person in the scene. In my head, the cowboy. And he was kind of like cool, calm, and collected. He was a bit like the voice of reason in the whole thing. I don't know how we differ so far on that one, Lipstick Singularity. Scully is Stephen Root. Stephen Root. I don't know who that is. Stephen Root. I'm going to have to Google that because, you know, otherwise I'm just going to be wondering. Oh, okay. I know his face. Where do I know his face from? Oh, man. He's one of those actors where it's like, yeah, I know him from heaps of things, but even looking at his face, I can't think of what he's in. Office Space. Dodgeball. No Country for Old Men. What's he the lead in? He must be the lead in something, right? Rango. Ice Age. Well, those are cartoons. That doesn't help. Oh, he's just one of those, like, supporting actors in heaps of stuff. Alright, okay. Who was that? Scully. Johnny is Spencer from Survivor. The mind works in mysterious ways, says Lipstick Singularity, but he seems smart yet sulky enough. Alright, Spencer from Survivor. Who the heck is that? From Survivor. Ah, Survivor's that reality TV show. Okay, there's no chance I was going to know who that one is. The Swede is Alexander Skarsgård. Cool, alright, I can see that. Does anyone else cast their imagination with real people? I feel like it helps my imagination to be more vivid, like a movie with mannerisms and dialect. If so, who did you cast? Right Way Up said Scully is Richard Attenborough, Jurassic Park era. Very cool. Johnny is Edward Furlong, Terminator 2 era. Mr. Blank is David Suchet. I don't know who that is either. Man, why do I not know all these actors? David Suchet. Poirot. Okay, vaguely. That's a very obscure actor. I vaguely recognize his face. I can't even tell you guys who it is by saying, "Oh, he's the guy who plays this person," because, yeah, too obscure. Cowboy is Harrison Ford. Yeah, okay, that's a good match. I can get on board with that one. Older, kind of a badass. The Swede is Vincent D'Onofrio from Full Metal Jacket. Most of these are thought of right now because it's fun. I don't really think of specific actors when I'm reading. I didn't have any actors in my head at all for this. But, oh man, who can I see as the Swede? Maybe someone like, who plays Pierre in the BBC War and Peace thing? Really famous actor. Is played by Paul Dano. Yeah, Paul Dano is my Swede. Kind of hapless, kind of panicky, a little bit neurotic. Cool. That's a fun game. Listeners, in tomorrow's discussion, or the discussion for Chapter 5, I should say, let's go further with this. I want to hear some more casts of who people are casting in this film, in this story, I should say. Techrific said, "Why the shift in the Swede? Well, what happened upstairs? Alcohol happened." You think that the entire shift in his persona, his attitude, I should say, is just due to the alcohol he drank? Could be the case. Dutch courage, as they say. But it was a dramatic shift. But I suppose he's kind of a volatile person, isn't he? So a dramatic shift shouldn't be so unexpected. He just seemed so, like, smug, almost. Like, overconfident. Techrific also said, "The Easterner is described as travelled. He's been silent for most of the chapters. Now he speaks, and he seems to be a measured and reasonable fellow." An old expression is lettered. He seemed lettered. Educated, in other words. One of the interesting features of a hotel is the collection of people from every walk of life that convene there. There's a beginning of a theme of class here, perhaps. Ah, okay. A bit of a division in the class of these people. Maybe. It's not a really stark, obvious division, if there is one. They all seem on a fairly equal playing field. Laurie Y. Stitch said, "Alcohol happened, yes, but what else? They were up there for a while and we don't know all that happened." Techrific said, "That's true enough. Maybe I was a little glib, but I think the operative thing that we know of was the alcohol, and Scully's efforts to put him at ease with talk of his family, his experience with death, his pride in his oldest son, etc." Well, he's certainly at ease. He's gone completely the other way, where he's too comfortable. It's weird. I love how weird this story is. It's you're in that perfect balancing act where you can't figure out what's going on, but it doesn't seem too surreal that it sort of loses you and you go, "Oh, this is just gibberish." Like, it seems like something's going on. It seems like it makes sense, but you just haven't cracked it yet. You haven't quite figured it out. It's a very fine line to tread as a writer, where, you know, if things don't make sense, at a certain point to the reader it will just seem like nonsense and they'll kind of tune out. But, you know, he's balancing, he's walking that fine line very, very well. Techrific said to me, "I love how you mentioned that you thought Scully was getting a gun for the Swede. I had the same first thought. Is this the first example of the slipstream genre? Crane is making us confused and crazy too." I gotta tell you, I don't know what the slipstream genre is, and I feel like as a writer myself, I should know what that is. Slipstream is a kind of fantastic or non-realistic fiction that crosses conventional genre boundaries between science fiction, fantasy, and literary fiction. Okay, alright. It seems like from what you said there, Techrific, that it's sort of meant to make the reader question their own grip on things. The coiner of the term slipstream, Bruce Sterling, wrote, "This is a kind of writing which simply makes you feel very strange." "I'll admit it," says Techrific, "I feel strange at times reading this, in a good way though. I didn't expect this at all, but Crane is fast becoming one of my favourite short story writers." Yeah, I think I might actually agree with that. This is certainly, this and The Open Boat are some of the best short stories I've read. And it just seems so ahead of its time, right? Like, the setting is, it's anachronistic, right? It seems like it's set in the late 1800s, but the writing style feels so modern. Lipstick Singularity said, "Same here. I think it was because he clearly went to great pains to make sure no one found out. Sorry, found no one found it." What's this? Oh, sorry. Okay, Lipstick is agreeing about thinking that the rolled up jacket contained a gun. "Same here. I think it's because he clearly went to great pains to make sure no one found it, which makes more sense with a weapon than with a vice. Is he religious, ashamed, worried a child will find it? Perhaps is a precious bottle meant for a specific occasion. Then, like the sweet, I thought he might poison him. Though I have no reason to believe this, by all accounts, he seems to be a kind gentleman. I guess we are both getting paranoid in this snowstorm. I didn't think he was going to poison the Swede, but I thought that the Swede thinks he's getting poisoned, or that he's trying to poison him. But then why did he drink the drink? Was it just one of those, oh, to hell with it type moments? Like he was just kind of resigning to whatever happens? So strange. Such a strange story. Right way up said, the Swede reminds me of someone who acts really tough when he feels someone has got his back. Even takes it further the way he talks to the only person who is on his side. The cowboy, Mr. Blanc, behave like little schoolboys when the teacher slash headmaster is around, so they won't act as long as Scully is present. Johnny may go against his father, but he seems kind of young. Scully seems too occupied with the hotel's reputation to risk doing anything. Techrific said, a bully fortified on drink, shouting at the only one who has been kind to him. Yeah, there's definitely a pathology going on here. Signature Fro said, I like that username too. Signature Fro said, it's interesting that Scully confessed to others that the Swede thought he was being poisoned upstairs. Instead of keeping that fact to himself and trying to resolve the situation independently, Scully is reaching out to the others for help and solidarity. Right way up said, yeah, that one really stood out. It felt out of character for Scully, so he must be really worried. You know what I think it was? Is that he walked in on the Swede freaking out and just assumed that the other guys had done something to stir up the Swede. And even though they were saying, oh, we didn't do anything, I think he just didn't believe them. He was thinking, well, this guy's clearly panicking, so there must be some reason for it. So he thought, I'll take him upstairs and I'll calm him down. I'll give him some alcohol and talk to him about my family. And I think that once he got him alone and had a chance to have a chat to him and saw how the guy was reacting and acting, that Scully started to maybe believe the other guys in that, oh, okay, no, this guy is a little bit crazy. But by then he'd made up his mind that he was going to figure this thing out, and that the Swede was, you know, he was adamant that the Swede was going to remain a welcome guest in his hotel by this point. So I think he had just finally come around to believing the other guys, and that him saying, him mentioning to the other guys that the Swede thought he was being poisoned is his way of saying, like, yeah, I've now witnessed this guy being unreasonably strange. Swim said, the mummifishy said, well, I was right from the third chapter. The Swede thought Scully was trying to poison him. Instead, the Swede has a good buzz going. Johnny has altogether too much power over the guests and his father, e.g. him refusing to move and the others acquiescing. I wonder why. Wasm said, I wonder if it's just the alcohol speaking or if something else happened upstairs that we as the readers are not privy to. Or maybe the Swede convinced himself of his safety and can act in earnest. As to the final lines, he wheeled suddenly upon the cowboy and the Easterner. Am I right? Not too afraid to say, but maybe too afraid to leave. Huh, Scully. Also, the Swede thinks he was being poisoned, but accepts the bottle and drinks deep. His lips curled absurdly around the opening, and his throat worked. I'm wondering if it's him thinking there's no way out anymore. He's unwilling to keep going in fear or whatever else might have made him like this. Yeah, I don't know, it's so pleasantly confusing. I often don't like a story where it keeps you confused for too long. You know, you don't want to be completely in the dark, just like not understanding what the heck's going on. But you get that perfect balance, like I was saying, that perfect balance of questions where you're intrigued, but you're not like frustrated at how little you can figure out. All right. I really need to know what's going on in this hotel, in this blue hotel. So, I'm going to continue the story. Here we go with The Blue Hotel, Chapter 5. At 6 o'clock supper, the Swede fizzed like a fire wheel. He sometimes seemed on the point of bursting into riotous song, and in all his madness he was encouraged by old Scully. The Easterner was encased in reserve. The cowboy sat in wide-mouthed amazement, forgetting to eat, while Johnny wrathily demolished great plates of food. The daughters of the house, when they were obliged to replenish the biscuits, approached as warily as Indians, and, having succeeded in their purpose, fled with ill-concealed trepidation. The Swede domineered the whole feast, and he gave it the appearance of a cruel bacchanal. He seemed to have grown suddenly taller. He gazed, brutally disdainful, into every face. His voice rang through the room. Once when he jabbed out harpoon fashion with his fork to pinion a biscuit, the weapon nearly impaled the hand of the Easterner, which had been stretched quietly out for the same biscuit. After supper, as the man filed towards the other room, the Swede smote Scully ruthlessly on the shoulder. "Well, old boy, that was a good square meal." Johnny looked hopefully at his father. He knew that shoulder was tender from an old fall, and indeed it appeared for a moment as if Scully was going to flame out over the matter. But in the end he smiled, a sickly smile, and remained silent. The others understood from his manner that he was admitting his responsibility for the Swede's new viewpoint. Johnny, however, addressed his parent in an aside. "Why don't you license somebody to kick you downstairs?" Scully scowled darkly by way of reply. When they were gathered about the stove, the Swede insisted on another game of high five. Scully gently deprecated the plan at first, but the Swede turned a wolfish glare upon him. The old man subsided and the Swede canvassed the others. In his tone there was always a great threat. The cowboy and the Easterner both remarked indifferently that they would play. Scully said that he would presently have to go to meet the 6:58 train, and so the Swede turned menacingly upon Johnny. For a moment their glances crossed like blades, and then Johnny smiled and said, "Yes, I'll play." They formed a square with the little board in their knees. The Easterner and the Swede were again partners. As the play went on, it was noticeable that the cowboy was not board whacking as usual. Meanwhile, Scully, near the lamp, had put on his spectacles and, with an appearance curiously like an old priest, was reading a newspaper. In time, he went out to meet the 6:58 train, and despite his precautions, a gust of polar wind whirled into the room as he opened the door. Besides scattering the cards, it dulled the players to the marrow. The Swede cursed frightfully. When Scully returned, his entrance disturbed a cozy and friendly scene. The Swede again cursed, but presently they were once more intent, their heads bent forward and their hands moving swiftly. The Swede had adopted the fashion of board whacking. Scully took up his paper and for a long time remained immersed in matters which were extraordinarily remote from him. The lamp burned badly, and once he stopped to adjust the wick. The newspaper, as he turned from page to page, rustled with a slow and comfortable sound. Then suddenly he heard three terrible words. "You are cheating." Such scenes often prove that there can be little of dramatic import in environment. Any room can present a tragic front. Any room can be comic. This little den was now hideous as a torture chamber. The new faces of the men themselves had changed it upon the instant. The Swede held a huge fist in front of Johnny's face while the latter looked steadily over it into the blazing orbs of his accuser. The Easterner had grown pallid. The cowboy's jaw had dropped in that expression of bovine amazement which was one of his important mannerisms. After the three words, the first sound in the room was made by Scully's paper as it floated, forgotten, to his feet. His spectacles had also fallen from his nose, but by a clutch he had saved them in air. His hand, grasping the spectacles, now remained poised awkwardly and near his shoulder. He stared at the card players. Probably the silence was while a second elapsed. Then, if the floor had been suddenly twitched out from under the men, they could not have moved quicker. The five had projected themselves headlong towards a common point. It happened that Johnny, in rising to hurl himself upon the Swede, had stumbled slightly because of his curiously instinctive care for the cards and the board. The loss of the moment allowed time for the arrival of Scully, and also allowed the cowboy time to give the Swede a great push which sent him staggering back. The men found tongue together, and hoarse shouts of rage, appeal, or fear burst from every throat. The cowboy pushed and jostled feverishly at the Swede, and the Easterner and Scully clung wildly to Johnny, but through the smoky air, above the swaying bodies of the peace compellers, the eyes of the two warriors ever sought each other in the glances of challenge that were at once hot and steely. Of course the board had been overturned, and now the whole company of cards was scattered over the floor, where the boots of the men trampled the fat and painted kings and queens as they gazed with their silly eyes at the war that was waging above them. Scully's voice was dominating the yells. "Stop now. Stop, I say. Stop now." Johnny, as he struggled to burst through the rank formed by Scully and the Easterner, was crying. "Well," he says, "I cheated. He says I cheated. I won't allow no man to say I cheated. If he says I cheated, he's a..." The cowboy was telling the Swede, "Quit now. Quit, do you hear?" The screams of the Swede never ceased. "He did cheat, I saw him, I saw him." As for the Easterner, he was importuning in a voice that was not heeded. "Wait a moment, can't you? Oh, wait a moment. What's the good of a fight over a game of cards? Wait a moment." In this tumult, no complete sentences were clear. "Cheat, quit, he says." These fragments pierced the uproar and rang out sharply. It was remarkable that, whereas Scully undoubtedly made the most noise, he was the least heard of any of the riotous band. Then suddenly there was a great cessation. It was as if each man had paused for breath, and although the room was still lighted with the anger of men, it could be seen that there was no danger of immediate conflict, and at once Johnny, shouldering his way forward, almost succeeded in confronting the Swede. "What did you say I cheated for? What did you say I cheated for? I don't cheat, and I won't let no man say I do." The Swede said, "I saw you, I saw you." "Well," cried Johnny, "I'll fight any man what says I cheat." "No, you won't," said the cowboy, "not here." "Ah, be still, can't you?" said Scully, coming between them. The quiet was sufficient to allow the Easterner's voice to be heard. He was repealing, "Oh, wait a moment, can't you? What's the good of a fight over a game of cards? Wait a moment." Johnny, his red face appearing above his father's shoulder, hailed the Swede again. "Did you say I cheated?" The Swede showed his teeth. "Yes." "Then," said Johnny, "we must fight." "Yes, fight," roared the Swede. He was like a demoniac. "Yes, fight. I'll show you what kind of a man I am. I'll show you who you want to fight. Maybe you think I can't fight. Maybe you think I can't. I'll show you, you skinned, you card sharp. Yes, you cheated. You cheated. You cheated." "Well, let's go at it then, mister," said Johnny coolly. The cowboy's brow was beaded with sweat from his efforts at intercepting all sorts of raids. He turned in despair to Scully. What are you going to do now? A change had come over the Celtic visage of the old man. He now seemed all eagerness, his eyes glowed. We'll let them fight, he answered stalwartly. I can't put up with it any longer. I've stood this damn Swede till I'm sick. We'll let them fight. Alright, there we go. Another chapter down. That was chapter 5, and I love that ending there. Scully is fed up, finally. Let them fight, he says. What a cliffhanger to end the chapter on. Let them fight. Scully gives it the go-ahead. Wow, I feel like the kids at school about to gather around, you know, after school. Meet me in the playground. And they all gather around, fight, fight, fight. That is pretty much how I feel right now. And it's exciting. Awesome, awesome stuff. Have your say about this chapter on the subreddit, reddit.com/r/TheHemingwayList. I'll drop a few questions in the discussion thread. Feel free to add your own questions, though, because sometimes mine aren't very thought-provoking. So if you can think of some better fodder to stir up conversation about Chapter 5, please go ahead and do exactly that. If you would like to support the podcast on Patreon, you can do so at patreon.com/TheHemingwayList. For as little as $1 per month, you can have all the pride of knowing that you helped make this podcast possible. $1 a month, that's 30 episodes for $1, or you can choose any value that you wish. Other than that, that's going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.